This is Nancy Dickerson of NBC News at the Capitol.
Despite his periodic trips abroad, much of the world feels it does not yet know Lyndon B. Johnson. President Kennedy had proved himself during times of crisis. A firm stand on the Russian missiles in Cuba. A quick response to repeated Soviet harassment along the Berlin Autobahn. These had given our allies around the world an awareness that the U.S. and its policies abroad do not fold up under communist pressure. But this feeling had developed before the tragic assassination. And now the question, what of the future? Will the Johnson administration be a continuation of Kennedy foreign policies? What of the Atlantic Alliance and of the war in Southeast Asia? An appraisal of the dramatic events of the past few days and what they mean to the future as seen in major capitals around the world. First, to the NBC post nearest the Iron Curtain, John Chancellor in Berlin.
The main question being asked here in Berlin tonight is, will the death of President Kennedy make a difference in the status of West Berlin? And the answer, from qualified observers, is no. That does not mean, however, that there will be no trouble in the coming weeks or months in Berlin or on the Autobahn which links it with the West or in its air corridors. The position of Berlin as a jousting ground for both sides in the Cold War was not altered or changed during the years of the Kennedy administration, and it is not likely to change during the tenure of the Johnson administration. The West will not pull out of Berlin short of war, and the Soviet Union will not start a war to force the West out. That was true under Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy, and it will be true under President Johnson. However, Berlin is an exposed, surrounded outpost tied to the West by slender and vulnerable threads in the air and on the ground. Since 1945, the Soviet Union has been whittling away the Western rights of access to Berlin, and that was going on earlier this month when the Russians held up an American convoy on the Autobahn. The dispute on the Autobahn is an ancient one by Cold War standards, and it remains unresolved. It appears likely that there will be other confrontations on the Autobahn, perhaps more erosion of Western rights on the road. But the Western commitment to West Berlin itself is too fundamental to the balance of politics in Central Europe to be changed by the death of one man, no matter how important he was, no matter how much he is mourned. But Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union are another matter. It is true tonight that the presses and transmitters of East European and Soviet propagandists are preparing an indictment of invective about the handling of the Lee Harvey Oswald case, and that the murder of President Kennedy will be depicted behind the Iron Curtain as the work of the extreme right in the United States. That is annoying, but perhaps not fundamental. What is fundamental is that the leader of the European communists, Nikita Khrushchev of the Soviet Union, had a working relationship with the leader of the West, John Kennedy. And these two men, with their enormous power and influence, had begun to set out some ground rules for peace and for an attempt at relaxation of the tension between the two powerful systems. The Test Ban Treaty was one example. The hotline between the White House and the Kremlin was another. The Russians recently puzzled the world when they arrested a distinguished American scholar for so-called espionage. But they returned to the fundamental agreement when President Kennedy personally intervened. The scholar was released because John Fitzgerald Kennedy put on the heat. Now, one of the two men accustomed to this high-level dialogue is gone, and means will have to be found to get it started again. That will take time. While it is going on, there will be further attempts to widen the commercial and cultural contacts with the countries behind the Iron Curtain. And these attempts will be led by America's allies in Europe, by the West Germans, by the British. The personality of John F. Kennedy had in the past been able to exert some American influence and control on these widening contacts between the West and the countries of Eastern Europe, contacts which bring both promise and danger to the West. In this field, the new American president will have his hands full. Wheat to Russia, most favored nation status to Yugoslavia and Poland, credits for expanded trade. They are all complicated. They are all critical to America's role in the new Europe. President Johnson faces a hard task in determining the course of American policy in these churning European waters. John Chancellor, NBC News, Berlin.
The Johnson administration and the unpredictable Charles de Gaulle is reported from Paris.
The president is dead and a new president is in office, and already throughout Europe and particularly in France, a big question is being asked. What does the tragic death of President Kennedy mean for the future? The French understand with their customary clarity that there is no more important individual in the Western world than the man who holds the office of President of the United States. For it is by his decision that the awesome power of the world's richest and most potently armed nation is wielded. Up to the moment of President Kennedy's assassination, President de Gaulle disagreed with many of his basic decisions and policies. President de Gaulle thinks very little of the United Nations as a peacemaking organization. He believes that the North Atlantic Treaty Organization ought to be reorganized to give the United States a smaller role and France a larger role in basic alliance policy. He is developing France's independent nuclear force despite American objections against nuclear proliferation. He does not believe in discussions with the Russians until they demonstrate that they are ready to make concessions. He has barred Great Britain from the common market. He has his own conception of European unification on the basis of national states and the Franco-German Treaty of Friendship. He is intent on eliminating American influence in Europe. In fact, President de Gaulle has been challenging American leadership on this continent, and has considerable reserves about the basic view of the late President of the United States on Atlantic partnership. All this makes quite a list of disagreements, and the list is by no means complete. Nonetheless, there is another side, a basic side, to French policy. It consists in complete loyalty to the Western Alliance as the essential framework of defense against the threat of communist aggression. In short, the agreement between France and the United States can be described as more basic than the disagreements, which are within the pattern of the alliance and aimed at attaining a greater voice within it for France. But the alliance itself has never been called into question, and as the Cuban crisis last year demonstrated, the United States has no ally more loyal than President de Gaulle. None of these French policies are likely to change as a result of President Kennedy's death. But in the highest French circles, there is some concern about what will happen to American policy. For President de Gaulle had a deep regard for President Kennedy. French ministers who have de Gaulle's ear have often told me that they, the French, if they had been American, would have handled matters exactly as President Kennedy handled them. There is no higher praise from one poker player to another. But President Lyndon Johnson, for the French, is an unknown quantity. He has already announced that he will follow the same foreign policy as that of President Kennedy. But there is always a style, a personal note to the way policy is pursued. And the French wonder whether President Johnson will have the size, the dynamism, the knowledge, the judgment, and the decisiveness that is required by a post of such awesome magnitude. I put this question to one of France's highest officials yesterday afternoon, and his reply was, "It is impossible to predict. Only the future will tell." This is Bernard Frizzell, NBC News, Paris.
Latin American reaction, where the Alliance for Progress has not been an unbounded success.
Argentina remains completely stunned by the assassination of President Kennedy, and for the moment at least, all differences between the two countries have dissolved, with Argentina joining the rest of the world in mourning. What will follow remains a question mark, but at this moment, there is no doubt of the sincere, deeply felt grief that the Argentines share with the United States over the loss. However, the questions most asked of all Americans living in Buenos Aires today is, who is this new president, and what is he like? In truth, Argentina, perhaps the best-informed nation of South America, knows almost nothing about President Johnson. And with the new government of Argentina just 6 weeks old, they've had all too little time to prepare themselves for the fantastic events that have followed. This was clearly visible in the abrupt halt to just about everything in Argentina until the government can come up with an estimation of what lies on the road ahead. Argentina and the United States currently are engaged in a serious dispute over the nationalization of the Argentine oil industry and the annulment of oil contracts with United States firms. Late Friday night, Foreign Minister Zavala Ortiz was to have delivered a major foreign policy address to the people of Argentina, presumably concerning Argentine-U.S. relations. The speech was postponed immediately upon receiving the news of President Kennedy's death, and it probably never will be delivered. Argentine Vice President Carlos Peretti and Foreign Minister Zavala Ortiz are in Washington today, not only for the funeral, but to try to get some feeling as to which way the United States winds now will blow under President Johnson. For the moment, the net effect on Argentine politics of the still unbelievable succession of events is that Argentina stands unified in bewilderment. The politicians and the government of President Illia seem to have forgotten all of their differences and are moving as a solid, unified bloc. The cabinet of Dr. Illia, which had not met even once since its appointment because of a wide range of differences, went into a solemn session which was described as singularly harmonious. But obviously, the government and the people of Argentina are waiting to know only one thing. How much friendship can they expect from President Johnson? What they have to work with now simply are past speeches by Mr. Johnson, with words such as those he issued on the second anniversary of the Alliance for Progress when he said, "In the long run, what has been started during these 2 years will have greater significance for the life of all of those who are called Americans than anything that has occurred in preceding centuries. Together, we will reach success." This is Ed Arno, NBC News, Buenos Aires.
Italy, troubled with its own political problems, takes a look at the White House.
The change in the American government through assassination coincides with a change in the Italian government through more conventional means. As in the case of Great Britain and West Germany, Italy, also a major member of the NATO alliance, is experiencing a change in leadership. There is anxiety in Italy during this period when its reins of government are changing hands. That anxiety is multiplied because Italy's main partner, the United States, suddenly has a new leader, too. Instead of one unknown, a new Italian government, there are now two unknowns, a new Italian government and a new American president. Lyndon B. Johnson should not be completely unknown to the Italian public. He has visited Italy, but President Johnson is unknown. His visit to Rome in September of last year was brief. Mr. Johnson had a private 40-minute audience with the late Pope John, and he signed an agreement with Foreign Minister Attilio Piccioni to cooperate in minor space research. But few Italians turned out to see Mr. Johnson. The newspapers paid little attention to the visit. Italians are notoriously indifferent to visiting dignitaries. Even the Italian leaders with whom Mr. Johnson met considered his visit more ceremonial than anything else and did not take the trouble to probe his political philosophies. Thus, Lyndon Johnson's accession to the presidency finds an element of apprehension among Italians. Italians knew John Kennedy. They admired him, respected him, were in a measure influenced by him. They present to President Johnson in their newspaper editorials and comments by political leaders an attitude of wishing him well, but of knowing him not at all well. The unknown is always unsettling. The new Italian leader with whom the new American president will probably have to deal is Aldo Moro, 47, a studious law professor, a longtime politician, a man of unusual patience and low-pitched emotions for an Italian. Like Mr. Johnson, Aldo Moro suffered a heart attack several years ago, recovered, and has continued his active political life. Moro is leader of the Catholic Christian Democratic Party and is on the verge of forming a coalition cabinet with three other parties. He is expected to form his cabinet in the next few days, but even that is not sure. Moro plans to include in his cabinet members of the Socialist Party. This is a bold experiment. The Socialists are Marxists and longtime collaborators with the Communists. The purpose of this strange marriage of Catholics and Marxists is to accomplish a long-needed legislative program of economic and social reforms, which more conservative Italian governments have neglected. The price for socialist support, however, may be a loosening in Italy's ties to NATO. The socialists are basically neutralists. They are willing to have Italy remain in NATO, but they want her participation to be passive. The socialists oppose President Kennedy's plan for a NATO nuclear army. The old adage of a chain being as strong as its weakest link applies to the Western Alliance. The old problem of a recalcitrant France confronts President Johnson as it did President Kennedy. But for President Johnson, there may now be the new problem of a reluctant Italy. Irving R. Levine, NBC News, Rome.
More comment now from Latin America.
President Goulart's office announced today that the Brazilian government believes there will be no changes in relations between Brazil and the United States with President Johnson. However, the same announcement said President Goulart will spend today with his close advisors studying the hemispheric implications of the death of President Kennedy. That announcement sums up what Latin America expects now that Mr. Johnson is the new U.S. president. They hope the policies of President Kennedy will continue, but they fear they will not. Latin Americans had great admiration for and placed great trust in President Kennedy. President Kennedy initiated the Alliance for Progress. Latin Americans believe this signaled a new economic era. President Kennedy personally visited four Latin American nations. Nearly every Latin American head of state visited President Kennedy. Latin Americans heralded these visits as evidence that personal relations with the White House were the best ever. Latin Americans place great reliance on personal relationships. Their greatest compliment is that a man is simpatico, sympathetic, congenial, admirable. President Kennedy was all these. Latin American politicians tend to distrust someone they do not know. Latin Americans do not know President Johnson. Editorials hint that Mr. Johnson is a right-wing reactionary. These same editorials imply that Mr. Johnson will not continue fighting for civil rights. These same editorials imply that the interest in Latin America will diminish now that Mr. Johnson is president. These interpretations are either unfair, inaccurate, or far too premature to have any validity. So most Latin American governments will wait a month or so to see what Mr. Johnson says and does about Latin American problems, about the Alliance for Progress, about canceled U.S. oil contracts, about the Panama Canal, or military takeovers. If President Johnson follows President Kennedy's policies, there may be misunderstandings, as there were before. However, at least Latin Americans will know where they stand. Officially, Latin American governments say they expect no changes in relations with the United States. Unofficially, Latin American nations are worried that without President Kennedy, dialogues between North America and Central and South America will be less sympathetic and less cordial. Wilson Hall, NBC News, Rio de Janeiro.
The government of Ludwig Erhard and its response.
West Germany's new chancellor, Ludwig Erhard, is looking forward to close relations with the new president of the United States. Erhard is 66, Johnson 55. Although vastly different in temperament and background, both men are disinclined to experimentation in domestic or foreign policy. Neither, however, could be called a diehard conservative. These considerations, among others, lead officials here in Bonn to take an optimistic view of relations between the Erhard and Johnson administrations in the year ahead. President Kennedy gained immense popularity here during his June visit, but former Chancellor Konrad Adenauer and some members of his Christian Democratic Party had misgivings about the youthful president's strategy of peace. They feared he might sacrifice German interests or at least perpetuate the division of Germany in his quest for understanding with the Russians. There's no evidence that Erhard ever shared these doubts, although he is known to have shared the widely expressed feeling here that the Kennedy administration had not adequately consulted Bonn before concluding the partial nuclear test ban treaty with Russia. West Germany belatedly signed the agreement after complaining that communist East Germany should not have been allowed to adhere. Erhard was due to have conferred with President Kennedy in Washington tomorrow and Tuesday. As it turns out, he'll see President Johnson at tomorrow's funeral services and hopes to have a chance for political talks before flying back to Bonn, probably Tuesday. The West Germans are eager to learn the new chief executive's intentions about continuing exploratory talks begun by his predecessor with Moscow. Erhard also wants to know whether Mr. Johnson intends to press the proposal for a mixed-manned Allied nuclear fleet. The Germans have agreed to take part in such a force and to pay a share of its $4 billion cost. Officials here who've seen Mr. Johnson in action in Washington and on two visits to Germany while he was vice president have considerable respect for his political savvy, especially his ability to handle Congress. They think this may mean better relations between Congress and the White House, even in an election year. In general, the feeling here is that the new president will carry on his predecessor's policy of close Atlantic partnership and maintenance of powerful American forces in Europe. This is welcome. It will be less welcome if President Johnson should press Bonn to fulfill completely its NATO force goal of 12 divisions. West Germany now has 11 divisions with a 12th in formation, but these forces lack artillery, signal, engineer, and other backup units required to make an effective army. Balanced forces mean an unbalanced budget, something that Erhard has sworn never to allow. Whatever disagreements Erhard and the new president may have in future, they're likely to try to play them down. Both leaders are feeling their way, and both are pledged to preserve the German-American alliance. Wells Hagen, NBC News, Bonn.
The Western alliance for many is symbolized by the longtime allegiance between the U.S. and England. Here is NBC's senior European correspondent, Joseph C. Harsh.
On the morning after John Kennedy died, the great tolling bell of Westminster Abbey spoke once each minute for an hour. The last previous time it tolled was when King George VI died. It had never before tolled for any American, president or otherwise. The throbbing hurt of that great bell registered a fact which had not until John Kennedy died been fully appreciated here. The fact that for the first time in history, our American president had become accepted and recognized as the true and lawful leader of the Western world. In the London Sunday Telegraph this morning, Peregrine Wersthorn perceptively noted that if President Kennedy had lived out his expectable 8 years as president, men would be speaking of the Kennedy era, as 100 years ago they spoke of the Victorian era. He had become as much the dominant figure of these times as Queen Victoria was the dominant figure of hers. One could almost translate this into antique political definitions and say that he had in truth, if not in title, become the Emperor of the West. He was not controversial here in Europe. He is undoubtedly mourned more universally here than at home. For here he had no political enemies. He was accepted, trusted, and respected as much among the ranks of labor as among Tories. He was seen only in his role as world statesman, and in that role he had come to be regarded as decisively successful. He's given the credit for pushing back communism and saving the peace at the same time. He brought the world into balance. The British particularly have felt safe and secure during the year between the Cuban crisis and the death of John Kennedy. It will be a year towards which many a nostalgic backward glance will be cast. For here, men cannot and do not yet look ahead with confidence. Perhaps the sense of pervasive doubt will swiftly be dispelled by President Johnson. But right now, in the shock of the loss of the known leader who had proven himself, people can only be anxious when the new leader in Washington is, to people here, the unknown president. Literally, no one here really knows Lyndon Johnson or much about him. He was a vague figure in the Washington background who spoke with an accent familiar here only in television westerns and on the vaudeville stage. That a man can speak with a Texas drawl and also be a world statesman is a possibility not before contemplated here. Perhaps it can happen. It never has yet. The fact that the trusted leader could in these modern times be assassinated in the United States is coupled with the unknown quality of his successor and sudden doubt about the outcome of next year's American election. The combination must inevitably, as it does, complicate the management of the alliance and affect the shape and direction of its growth. Certainly the British and French will be more reluctant than ever to leave alliance strategy and nuclear weapons entirely to the United States. The trend must be towards nationalism and independent lines of action. Confidence in a nation which can assassinate a great world figure is shaken, and it cannot be immediately restored. Already this morning, the former Sir Anthony Eaton, now Lord Avon, was saying that the death of President Kennedy will result in greater responsibilities for Britain. Behind that statement lies the thought that it must be some time, if ever, before the peace of the world can again be as solidly founded as it has come to be of recent times on the respect of Nikita Khrushchev for John Kennedy. One reason the peace was founded on John Kennedy was because he was expected to be reelected. Allies and enemies all thought ahead in terms of continuity of American policy for another 5 years. Now they have no assurance of continuity. The president could be Lyndon Johnson for a year and then some other person even less widely known. The possibility of three different American presidents in 3 years of time makes us begin to appear in foreign eyes to be as politically unstable as France did before de Gaulle. One danger is that the Russians will attempt to take advantage of the new uncertainty. If their behavior follows the normal patterns, they will test with the new president with threat and perhaps with a new probing adventure. Another danger frequently mentioned here today was that America will get a rush of blood to the head and itself do something rash and unnecessarily dangerous. President Johnson now has the difficult and perhaps impossible task of winning for himself the confidence which our allies had placed in his predecessor. It took President Kennedy 2 years to win that confidence. It is asking a lot to expect it to be given in shorter time to another man. But to try to end this on a hopeful note, it is also possible that the Allies will now be ready to shoulder a larger share of the burden of defending the West. Joseph C. Harsh, NBC News, London.
November 22nd, 1963. Shortly after noon, two shots ring out from an assassin's rifle, and the course of world history is changed. A young man dies, and all the world pays a reverent tribute. A president leaves the White House in a flag-draped coffin, and people everywhere share the grief of his wife and family. The simple statistics will list him as John Fitzgerald Kennedy, 1917 to 1963, the 35th president of the United States. But the statistics can never tell the story of love and admiration felt by the factory worker in Chicago, the housewife in Los Angeles, the man in the street in Boston or Tallahassee or Wichita. The act of assassination is foul enough. But for it to claim a young and attractive man, a person of dedication, a president who in 2 years and 10 months did so much, this indeed is the highest price.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
This is Russ Ward, NBC News, New York.
Following a 10-second pause for station identification, the NBC Radio Network will continue its coverage as Morgan Beatty and the NBC News staff summarize this second unbelievable day following the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Immediately following this news program, NBC will present a short interlude, Alexander Scourby and the musical work The Testament of Freedom. We pause now 10 seconds for station identification.
This is WMAQ and WMAQ-FM in Chicago.
Now for NBC News, here is Morgan Beatty.
The time by human clocks at this moment, 11:21 p.m., close to the total waning of the second day. The time by the calendar at this moment is November the 24th, 1963, almost 50 and a half hours after the assassination of the President of the United States in the county of Dallas, state of Texas. The time is less than 24 hours after the suspected killer was just as wantonly wounded fatally in the basement of the Dallas City Jail, before the listening ears and watching eyes of a whole nation, a whole world. The time has come once again to summarize this terrible and untidy span of time and the action that has taken place within its terrible sequences. As we broadcast to you now, the 80,000th plain citizen stands in a line 26 blocks long and several abreast in our nation's capital. Number 80,000 will soon pass in the double line before the catafalque where lies the body of John F. Kennedy. It was placed there just after noon today, where Lincoln and more than a dozen other selected American citizens have lain in state in notice of their service to the nations. On the minds and in the torn hearts of the mourners, who symbolize all of us, are the names of two men almost nobody ever heard of before 1 o'clock Eastern Standard Time on Friday. These two men, Lee Harvey Oswald, the loner, the American citizen who had not confessed, but who had been charged with the murder of the president and the wounding of John Connally, the governor of Texas. And that other equally bizarre character who, like Oswald, thrust himself unwanted into the history books of the world, Jack Ruby, a scrappy human cur, a product of the streets of the city of Chicago, now a resident of Dallas. He has admitted he took the law into his own hands. He dashed past police guards before noon today, thrust a snub-nosed .38 revolver into the soft stomach of Lee Oswald, who was being transferred from city jail to county jail, and fired. The bullet ended Oswald's life less than 2 hours later. Ruby told his sister in jail tonight, "I had to do it. Don't worry about me." In Washington, the security officialdom of the nation looked with shocked misgivings on the whole incredible tale from the Southwest. They heard with dismay the statement of District Attorney Henry Wade in Dallas County that he would not release the piece of evidence in hand. They were relieved shortly after when he agreed to release all of the evidence concerning Lee Oswald, the evidence concerning the end of the president's life. Federal authorities are positively committed, as is the mayor of Dallas, Earl Cabell. This record must be and is now being given to posterity. Back in Washington, a diplomatic mystery. What goes through the minds of the visiting dignitaries from around the world at this close to midnight hour? We cannot know. Our State Department had assured all nations that ambassadors may well represent any nation at the president's final funeral passage to Arlington Cemetery tomorrow. Nevertheless, 84 nations so far have deemed it important and meet, even including our primary rival in the world, Russia, to send the highest officials they can spare to Washington as a special mark of respect. Tomorrow they will take part in majestic passage from the rotunda of the Capitol to the White House and to St. Matthew's Cathedral for final requiem mass. Some will join the cortege at the White House with Mrs. Kennedy and walk the final 5 blocks to hear an appeal to a higher than human power for mercy on all men and their souls. That, in summary, is the series of events that will be written into history. A most unclassic sequence of tragedy, including all but its final and public act tomorrow. And now the summary in detail. First, to Bryson Rash, NBC News, in the rotunda of the Capitol of the United States.
The day here started at just before 2 p.m., but an hour before that, at 1 p.m., the president's body was placed on a caisson and taken, brought here to Capitol Hill. It was then lifted up the great white steps and placed at rest in the exact center of the rotunda, the head pointed directly west, the feet pointed to the east. And then, in very brief and moving ceremonies, there were three eulogies spoken. One by the Majority Leader of the Senate, Senator Mike Mansfield, by the Chief Justice of the United States, Earl Warren, and by the Speaker of the House of Representatives, John McCormick. A president's wreath was then placed in position at the foot of the casket in which lies the body of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Mrs. Kennedy had brought both of her children into the rotunda with her. Young John Jr. left within a very few moments. Caroline stayed on. Then Mrs. Kennedy, with Caroline at her side, went to the catafalque, kneeled for just a moment in prayer, and kissed the flag-draped casket, and then returned to her position. There were more than 1,000 of the highest dignitaries of the United States government gathered here to pay their respects and to honor the late president. The diplomatic corps was represented by its dean, Ambassador Sevilla Sacasa of Nicaragua. And then the dignitaries left and the public took over. They took over at about 3 o'clock, and they had been pouring through the rotunda ever since that moment. It is estimated that perhaps as many as 75,000 have come through here up to this time, from 3 o'clock until 11 o'clock. That figure may be high, but it is an estimate. It is also estimated that there are still remaining to come into the rotunda more than 200,000 people. The line extends for approximately 32 blocks in Washington, 16 blocks in one direction, and then it doubles back on itself for an additional 16 blocks. And they continue to pour through here. In order to expedite their passage through the rotunda, the line has been doubled so that they go by two abreast. The ropes have been moved very close to the casket now, perhaps 10 feet or less, and they go by quite rapidly. And in the midst, as this line goes through, the people have been standing in line for up to 7 hours to view this scene of their late president. And in the midst of this, from time to time, have come visits by distinguished people. The ambassadors have come. The president of Ireland, Mr. Emin de Valero, visited just a short while ago. The president's family has been here frequently. Mrs. Rose Kennedy, the president's mother. Mrs. Eunice Shriver, the wife of the director of the Peace Corps. Mrs. Ethel Kennedy, the wife of the Attorney General. And Mrs. Joan Kennedy, the wife of the senator from Massachusetts. They have visited here to be with their brother for just a moment in peace. But perhaps the most dramatic of all the visitations here tonight was a return by Mrs. Jacqueline Kennedy. She arrived in the rotunda shortly after 9 o'clock. She was accompanied by her brother-in-law, the brother of the president, Attorney General Robert Kennedy. They went inside the enclosure, roped off by velvet ropes, and Mrs. Kennedy went to the casket alone for just a moment, kneeled, or rather genuflected, touched the casket, and left. At the present moment, astronaut John Glenn Jr. and his wife have appeared here on the rotunda with their two children to pay their respects to the late President Kennedy. I beg your pardon. It is John Glenn and Mrs. Glenn. Their children are not with them. The astronaut files by slowly with Mrs. Glenn. They look at the casket, and now they turn and leave the rotunda. To continue the day, Mrs. Kennedy came shortly after 9 o'clock. Unannounced, she genuflected beside the casket and then left with the Attorney General. She spoke to people as she left and then went down the broad stairway to a waiting limousine. But Mrs. Kennedy said that she would prefer to walk. So the two of them, the Attorney General and the widow of the President of the United States, set off arm in arm across the darkened East Plaza. They walked across a grassy plot. There were no people nearby. Accompanying them were a handful of Capitol Police, perhaps four, and one Secret Service man, maybe five reporters following that small group. We reporters were asked not to interfere with her solitude or with her peace. We did not, of course. Then Mrs. Kennedy walked across the plaza past the Senate wing of the Capitol and plunged through a crowd that had was milling on the sidewalk. She was not recognized. Mrs. Kennedy was wearing a black coat, and her hair was down in a black scarf. Her face did not have a veil. She then walked down Capitol Hill through the twisting driveways between parked automobiles on the grass. People coming up Capitol Hill did not recognize her. She got to the corner of First and Constitution Avenue, accepted the condolence offered by someone. By this time, she had been recognized by just a handful of people, perhaps 10 or so, and they dropped into line behind the reporters. Then Mrs. Kennedy and the Attorney General walked south on First Street. That block from the Capitol building to First Street is a great, long, generous block. And she turned first, then she turned south on First Street. She stopped to speak to a group of nuns. They offered their sympathy. She thanked them. She walked on down First Street. And the Attorney General spoke to her quietly. She nodded her head. The Secret Service asked police for assistance, and traffic was stopped. Her limousine had followed her down the hill. It was in the middle of the street when it was stopped, and Mrs. Kennedy and the Attorney General wove their way out to the automobile, got in, drove off, presumably back to the White House. The absolutely most intriguing part of this was the fact that Mrs. Kennedy was not recognized. Those who did recognize her respected her completely and left her alone to be with the Attorney General in this moment of great sorrow. Tomorrow, the program, or rather the schedule for the day, begins at 10 a.m. when the doors here at the Rotunda are closed, and it is quite likely there will still be people waiting to get in to view the catafalque and the casket containing the body of the president. The late president's body will be taken from the Rotunda at 11 a.m. and on a cortege. It will be placed on a caisson, and in a cortege will be taken to the White House. Their other dignitaries will join the group. From the White House, it will go to St. Matthew's Cathedral in Washington. Mrs. Kennedy and heads of state and other dignitaries plan to walk that five blocks from the White House to St. Matthew's for this farewell mass. The mass should be over shortly after 1 p.m. After mass, the funeral cortege goes to Arlington Cemetery and symbolically past the Lincoln Memorial. It will arrive at Arlington at approximately 2:15, and the burial will occur shortly thereafter. Mrs. Kennedy will then return to the White House, where she will receive the heads of government and the other foreign dignitaries who will fly here to Washington for this final day. At 7 p.m., President Lyndon Baines Johnson will receive the heads of state at the State Department in Washington. This is Bryson Rash, NBC News, reporting from the Rotunda in Washington.
A report from where the plain people of our nation, symbolized by the plain people of the city of Washington, D.C., and surrounding territories in Maryland and Virginia, are paying their respects to the late President Kennedy. The dignitaries on this day had their place in a historic moment, and they were those people who came here to pay respects, as we have said, from 84 nations, and maybe more will be represented by dignitaries by tomorrow. Of course, the chief of all of them, by protocol, is President Charles de Gaulle of France. He is chief by protocol for the simple reason that he is the only chief of state and head of government so far to arrive here. The President of the United States is Chief of State and Head of Government. France and the Fifth Republic is the only nation in the world that has a major nation that has a Chief of State who is also Head of the Government and by protocol is equal to the President of the United States. President Charles de Gaulle arrived late today. He was greeted by Secretary of State Dean Rusk at International Airport. That's one of the four airports that are receiving dignitaries. and taken immediately to the French embassy. He has stated before that he felt it absolutely necessary that he be here in his own personal presence to represent the people of France. And as he walked through the airport after shaking hands with those necessary to greet him, he spoke to his associates. Allons, allons, he said, 3 or 4 times. Let's go. And they went to the French embassy. Also on hand already are Prime Minister Ikeda of Japan and Eamon de Valera of Ireland, the president of a nation who is in his 81st or 82nd year. He's almost totally blind. And then came West German Chancellor Earhart, accompanied by his foreign and defense ministers. And there's Britain's Prince Philip, who represents Queen Elizabeth of England, who cannot come because she is near the time of a child, a third child. And there's Russia's first deputy premier, Anastas Mikoyan, representing Premier Khrushchev. Well, he will arrive early tomorrow morning. Premier Khrushchev has insisted that Russia should be represented. He did this as a mark of respect not only to the American people, he said, but because President Kennedy is a realist for peace, and he admired this man. Incidentally, Prince Philip was not only greeted by our Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, but as a measure of respect, all of the ambassadors of the Commonwealth nations of Britain were on hand to greet him when he arrived. And, of course, there was an extremely busy day in Washington for the President of the United States, Lyndon Baines Johnson. President Johnson is conducting his business from his home in Spring Valley, a home he acquired from Pearl Mesta, a Washington hostess, 2 years ago. The Secret Service are there, the only mark that it differs from any other home in this rather plush area near Washington. The president conducted business all day because he felt that some things had to go on, some things of great importance. Perhaps he even thought that we should know that the business of the government, our continuing government, was being handled. The first official act of the president in his first full day in the office of chief executive was to reaffirm the policy objectives of John Kennedy in South Vietnam, where there's trouble with the Viet Cong communists. President Johnson received Henry Cabot Lodge, Jr., the ambassador to Vietnam, who had previously been summoned to Washington by President Kennedy. A rather quaint note here in protocol and deference. Ambassador Lodge had stopped in San Francisco, and he was resting there before having his appointment on this Sunday with President Kennedy when he heard of the death of his chief executive. Ambassador Lodge immediately announced that he would proceed to Washington to report to the Secretary of State it would be presumptive on his part, presumptuous, to make a report to a president who had not asked for one. Today, President Johnson, despite all of the pressing duties around him, asked for that report to stress the continuity of our policies in Southeast Asia. And the White House disclosed our forces in that part of the world will be withdrawn as soon as possible, and the schedule for withdrawal already set by President Kennedy will be carried forward under President Johnson. And the announcement was made by Pierre Salinger, President Kennedy's news secretary. And he noted that the president would leave up to the intelligence of the officials involved how long they wished to serve him there. Incidentally, it's already been noted that President Johnson asked all ambassadors and all cabinet officers to continue to serve. Dignitaries, business in Washington. Incidentally, permission was given today for the national banks to close. It is assumed that savings and loan institutions will close, along with state banks all over the world, for the final requiem mass for John Fitzgerald Kennedy tomorrow. Inevitably, at this point, we must go by contrast. It draws us like a magnet, the scene in Dallas of the second tragedy. It was about 10 o'clock today, apparently, that this scene began to unfold, the part of it that we tell you now was not known to the public or to anyone when it began. It was a moment when a nightclub operator in Dallas, Texas, got into his automobile and drove from that club four blocks to the Dallas City Jail. In the jail was, of course, Lee Oswald, the suspected killer of President Kennedy. Jack Ruby, the nightclub operator, parked his automobile across the street from the basement of the jail and walked rather hastily across the street. And then he leaped over a 3-foot barrier and dashed, before anybody could do anything about it, dashed into the basement of the jail. Inside, reporters, policemen, guards were waiting for the transfer of Lee Oswald from the jail to an armored car to be taken for safekeeping into the county jail of Dallas County. No one could have known what would happen next, but it so happened that the world saw it. The whole world saw what happened next. The murder of Lee Oswald. Here is that scene.
There is Lee Oswald. He's been shot. He's been shot. Lee Oswald has been shot. There's the man with a gun. It's absolute panic. Absolute panic here in the basement of Dallas Police Headquarters. Detectives have their guns drawn. Oswald has been shot. There is no question about it. Oswald has been shot. Pandemonium has broken loose here in the basement of Dallas Police Headquarters.